KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's almost too bad that my guest Emilio Estevez used the title Wisdom for his first film, because it's a title that could apply to almost every film he's made as writer-director. And those films include, of course, The War of Home, Rated X, Bobby, The Way, which we're going to be talking about today. As an independent filmmaker, I have to say that my guest, as often as not, puts his money where his mouth is. There's always a pleasure having me to talk to him. So, Emilio, good to talk to you, man. How are you?
Elvis, it's so nice to talk to you, man. And again, I want to say, and I need to say, congratulations for, as one independent filmmaker to another.
Gosh, thank you so much. I can tell you my feet are pretty hot right now. Anyway, we're here to talk about you. And thinking about this film, the beginning of The War at Home, where your character and your mother, played by Kathy Bates, you're talking about Thanksgiving. And I was thinking about how that scene is almost really the something that is at the heart of everything you do as a storyteller, which is that two points of view and people just aren't listening to each other as they talk.
No, indeed. And she has that wonderful line. She says, you know, we're talking about the celebration of Thanksgiving. And she says, well, I don't understand, you know, that I don't see what the Indians have ever had anything to be thankful for. and my care. My character Jeremy just looks at her and just says, basically that, exactly, right? It's just one of those hilarious moments that's just so, also it's just so painfully honest.
That moment is something that you visit so often as a storyteller, these people who just aren't listening to each other, who are talking, and their family as often as not.
That's right.
Trying to talk to each other and trying to be heard. And that's really so central for the way you think as a dramatist, isn't it?
Well, it is, because I think, again, we have such a hard time, I think, as beings, not only just being heard, but listening. And I think some of the best performances, the best actors that we see on screen have mastered the art of listening, right? And it's those quiet moments. It's taking the other person in and hearing them. And I think oftentimes, just in real time, in the real world, we don't listen to each other. We don't absorb the pain of the person that we're talking to, the trauma. And you and I have talked about trauma before, so and gone into great detail about the trauma that we carry. And I think that with that, with film especially, it's acknowledging that pain, acknowledging that trauma in the other character, but also in the real world. We don't do that enough.
It's so interesting because, you know, with The Way, which is a movie, as you know, I have a lot of respect for, it's almost that trauma that we talked about before is kind of a original sin, isn't it?
It is that. And I think you have this relationship between a father and son. And in this film, obviously played by my real father, Martin, and I, and we're not, we can't meet at that middle place. We're incapable of seeing eye to eye on pretty much anything in the film. And that is, again, I think so what I think prevents people from reaching each other. It's like, you know, I see you, brother, but I can't reach you. These guys don't even see each other, right? Let alone reach each other. And it takes the death of the son to finally force the father to not only make the journey, but also meet him. And unfortunately, you know, he has to experience that profound loss before he can figure out what his son was all about.
It's interesting, too, because this film and so many of the things you've done, we talked about this the last time that you were here, about that sort of the difference between, I guess, sort of faith and religion. And that's a big question in this movie, isn't it?
It is. And yet it's not a faith-based film, but it is. It is about having faith. It's about taking that leap of faith. It's about, you know, what else is out there? Where am I going? And not only in my life, but in my relationships. And what is my relationship to not only to other people, but to God, to the great mystery, whatever we choose to call it. But that's really where this film, it does dwell. And it also dwells in this desire, I think, that we all have to find community, because the community that we oftentimes are rejecting is sometimes the community that we need the most. And that is where Tom actually comes to find himself, through this community of fellow pilgrims along this journey, and reconnects with his faith and finds himself and becomes a father in many ways to these other pilgrims who he picks up along the way, in many ways that he couldn't be to his own son. So he finds the son, he finds his faith, and he experiences the journey, not only along these 500 miles along the Camino de Santiago, but he discovers the journey to himself. And by the end of the film, he becomes a citizen of the world again, which is something that we don't really see coming in the beginning. He's this country club guy. You know, his idea of a foursome is he's four doctors playing golf at the country club, and he doesn't even walk. He's in the golf cart and he's lazy, and he lives a very privileged life. But by the end of the film, he is fully realized. He is fully himself. And like I said, a citizen of the world. And it really sets it up for a sequel, because he's a character that I want to spend some more time with. I want to know where he is 10 years later. And so I've been working on that, by the way.
For Tom, played by your dad here, Martin Sheen, in the film, it really is a small world. It's a fixed world for him. And something we touched on a little bit last time, but it's this thread that runs through your film, this idea of trauma visit on a family, and how they can't recognize the effect, or they refuse to recognize it, especially these people, often not these guys, these fixed points of view, refuse to sort of recognize how badly hurt they are.
That's right. And again, we open the movie not only with the death of the son, but we also, in a flashback, we're post-funeral death of the mother. So Tom is essentially an orphan in the world. He has no family. And through this trauma and through both of these deaths, he's forced to reexamine himself and his own personal shortcomings as a father, as a human being.
I mean, the first third of the movie, it really takes its time. And I want to talk to you about that because you throw us into these worlds really kind of pell-mell in the other films you made. But in the way, it's a really sort of languorous first act.
It is. And when you're making a film about walking, which, living in Hollywood, you go into these offices and you're pitching this idea of this film. And you, people say, well, where are the car chases and where's the explosions? I said, no. This is a movie about walking 500 miles. And you know that the eyes glaze over and they can't wait for you to leave their office because they just can't wrap their brains around that. And mind you, there was a 2-hour and 45-minute version of the film that we test screened, and people said, don't cut a frame. So the first act was even longer, but the intention was to not just parachute the audience onto the Camino de Santiago, but to get them there gradually. It was a little bit of a lesson. You have to, explain where it is, first of all, explain who is out there on pilgrimage, explain why they do it. And all of that, it does take the first act to sort of set up the story, but it also sets up the character. And he is the least likely guy that would go on pilgrimage. He doesn't even know where it is. So through his eyes, his son has been traveling for the last couple of years. He leaves Berkeley. He announces he's leaving his PhD program. He's going to travel abroad. He even says, I want to be like Margaret Mead. If I'm a cultural anthropologist, I have to get my hands in the dirt. I have to feel it and taste it and live it. And his dad obviously doesn't understand that. So when we pick up the story and Daniel's death, he's been on the road for years. He's been out of touch with his father. So his dad not only just doesn't know where the Camino de Santiago is, but he doesn't even really know where his son's been over the last few years, aside from a few postcards. But Daniel's not a guy that has a cell phone. He really wanted to unplug and hit his own personal reset button, which, I think a lot of people are doing as we're coming out of COVID. I think that forced You know, the film in many ways was way ahead of its time. I think we, in the 12 years since the initial release, I think a lot of us have had to hit the reset. I think a lot of us have had to refocus and ask ourselves what's important. I think most of us haven't really grieved the loss of was it 1.2 million American lives, not to mention 6 million worldwide.
It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcow.com/The Treatment. We're talking about reflection with our old friend Emilio Estevez and revisiting his film, The Way, which is he's gotten the rights back to. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But I did think that one of the things the film has to offer now, and especially thinking about that first act, it's about sort of taking measure of where we are. And we feel lost, and we have felt lost for the past few years. And a movie that sort of asks us to sort of take all that in, and I think in almost a textual way, is what the film is doing. Again, especially in that first act, isn't it?
It is indeed. It asks the audience to say, hang on, it's okay to grieve. It's okay to acknowledge the loss. It's okay to process your trauma. And because that's, I believe that's the only way we're able to move on and start the healing process. And by the end of the film, I think, you know, anyone who sees it knows that Tom is healed by the end. He's processed his grief. He's processed that loss.
But I also think, too, at the end, he's become curious. So he's maybe he's processed that loss, but he now has questions about the world he didn't have when the film started.
He does indeed. And that is why I believe that it really sets it up for a second part, because I want to see where that character goes. And so I've developed this whole scenario where he's in Nigeria and he's with Doctors Without Borders and he is performing cataract surgeries in a remote village in the northern part of the country. And we see him as a full human being, as a full citizen of the world. And it's just an exciting evolution of that character for part two. And again, I that last shot in Morocco, we went to Morocco from Madrid for one shot with a 600 millimeter lens. I wanted to show him walking through the souk. People said, well, you know, we could shoot that here in Spain. I said, no, we have to go to the place. We have to show his evolution. We have to show him in a marketplace, walking amongst the people, and show him how evolved he has become. And so now that particular shot is really the whole movie for me, and the whole and that embodies who that character has become. So that excited me enough to want to really entertain this idea of spending some more time with Martin Sheen, because I mean, who doesn't? Right?
I would no disagreement here. We're going to take a short break. We're talking to my guest, Emilio Estevez, the writer-director of the film The Way. Is The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. My guest, who doesn't know what respect really means, is Emilio Estevez. This film we're talking about, of course, is The Way from, my gosh, 2010. It's been a while already. Been a minute. You can also see the show at kcow.com. One of the things that I'm so impressed with you as a filmmaker is that you use your films as a way, in every single film that you've directed and written, going all the way back to That Was Then, This Is Now, everything you've written has been really sort of about mental health in one way or another.
It has indeed. And I think from my own personal mental health, it was to try to get this movie back out into cinemas and get it back out into, well, because I had so much invested in it. And not only just time, but, you know, we were financing this film in Spain on our credit cards. My mom was using her points to fly actors over so that we could make parts of Spain look like Ventura, California.
Oh my gosh.
We were doing whatever we could to get this thing up and running. And then, of course, we released it in 2010 in Europe and in 2011 in the United States. And we went on a bus tour, and I went to 35 cities with my dad and my son on this tour bus. And we had, it was like a 50-day tour. And then the film came out and it did pretty well, but we ran out of dough in terms of a promotion. And then the film had this healthy life on streaming services and on DVD. And then the company that was distributing the film went into bankruptcy. And then the film found itself in a Delaware court with 1,000 other movies with a motion to abandon rights. So the film literally had to be rescued. And so this boutique company approached me in 2020 in the middle of COVID and said, a lot of people love your movie. And I said, yeah, I'm aware of that. I said, I will get the rights back to it at a certain point, but it's languishing in this motion to abandon rights courtroom. He says, I think I can help you get it out of there. This gentleman named Chris Bueno says to me, who runs Ocean Avenue Entertainment. So over the past couple of years, we've been working to rescue the movie, to reboot it, rebrand it, and then get it back out there. And I have to go back to your movie because you said something interesting about, yeah, and it was your grandmother said pride, talked about pride and about, you know, your work being, you know, is it prideful can you just simply enjoy the work? Can you enjoy the fact that you made it, that you created a piece of art? I kind of wrestled with that because I thought, well, is it prideful for me to want to put this movie back in the theaters? Because normally that's not done. Normally an independent movie has a life. And then it, you know, it disappears essentially, especially in indies. I mean, I don't know if the numbers were pretty extraordinary on about 750 theaters. We did more in one night than my last film, The Public, did in its entire run worldwide. Wow. So then I have to go back and ask myself that question about pride versus people versus just being happy with the work. You know, I don't know if I can answer that, but I'm asking myself the question, was it ego? Or was it just the desire to share something with people who I knew needed this movie now, especially coming out of COVID?
When I've talked to people about this movie, it's this thing they talk about with this almost sense of ownership, being moved by that journey, not just the literal journey, but the physical journey. And we get the chance to sort of see what that physical exertion does to Tom. He almost goes into a fugue state by exerting himself, right, getting out that golf cart and being among people and having his feet, right, be on the ground. And people are really taken by that. It's this tactile thing that the movie brings for a lot of people.
Well, it is. And I may never make another film in my lifetime that actually inspires people to, as soon as the movie ends, get up off the couch, go book their tickets to Spain, buy a backpack, some hiking shoes, and go walk 500 miles. I don't remember a movie that you last saw that you said, I've got to do that. That exists. I can do that. And people in their 60s, in their 70s, even folks in their 80s are saying, I have to go do that. I'm called to do that.
There's a lot of silence in the film. I think people get a chance to sort of live in it. There's this sense of discovery that happens in it. And we're feeling that discovery, I feel like, almost along with you as the storyteller. And that's something that the movie's able to impart and create this appetite for discovery.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I think that silence on film is a rarity, especially these days when people believe that louder is better. But you have to have an actor that you can trust in the silence. Every actor brings a certain amount of agreement that they have with an audience. And Martin has this just a gravitas about him, and he can hold the frame and he's allowed to be in that silence. That's his agreement. And we think about him in the West Wing and those moments of silence where he's in the Oval Office and he's contemplating some, you know, massive decision that's going to affect millions of lives. His face, he commands the room. He can hold the silence. Not every actor can. Again, it's not that it's a skill so much, is that it's about the agreement that actor has with an audience and what the audience, how far that audience will go with that actor. Like Meryl Streep, you know, the agreement that the audience has with Meryl is that she could play any voice at any time, any character. They'll walk with her. They'll take that pilgrimage with her. And Martin has that same thing with the silence.
When I watched for the first time, I found myself thinking about the way the silences he holds in Badlands and about how resolute that character is. And that's a character who doesn't change, in effect, but this is a guy who, right, does change, and he's fighting the change. I mean, in that second act, we can sort of see how painful this all is to be sort of shaken out of his first world, his industrialized world arrogance. He's got this fixed idea of what he's going to get from this trip.
Right.
And it's not really exercise. It's not really sort of having the scales fall. He's just going to go and do this thing because it's this thing you do. because as an American, right. this is who you are and this is what you do. And he has to finally be around people. He has to get out of himself. As much as anything, this is really about us and your trust in actors and the way all these people affect him. And I hate to use this word, but it's almost Old Testament to me.
Well, it is about trust. It is about having that leap of faith. And I think as a director, it is so much in the casting and having that trust in your actors and knowing that they're going to lead the way. You can only sort of set up the scenarios and hope that there's trust all around. Oftentimes actors will come to a set very distrustful of their director because they've been burned so many times.
Was this the case here? Was he distrustful of you asking this of him?
No, not my father. Some of the other actors, there was, you know, the gentleman that plays the Dutchman, Yorick, he didn't want to fall to his knees at the end. And I said, hey, man, you're the only one who can do it. He said, well, yeah, well, why aren't I? You know, I'm the only one doing it. I'm the only one following him. It's like, no, Yorick, man, it's transformational. This is not going to be embarrassing. This is going to be a real moment. And the audience is going, they're with you, man. They're pulling for you. And you have to trust. And he did reluctantly, but it's one of the most breathtaking moments in the film.
But there are a lot of breathtaking moments in it. It's just because the movie really sort of takes its time to breathe and just sort of trust the natural sounds. And again, I just want myself to think about Badlands, but also that he plays a character of faith in the execution of Private Slovak. It's that faith that sort
That's
of
right.
keeps him fired up. And all these things that you've seen in him over the years led you to offer this vote of confidence. I mean, because it's a lot to ask physically of an actor
right.
of that age to do something. It's a really demanding piece of work.
Right. I mean, yeah. And he insisted that his backpack be of a certain weight. In fact, it was probably a lot heavier than most pilgrims who actually do the Camino, but he packed it with rocks and whatever he could. The thing probably weighed 40 pounds. And at one point I thought he was exhausted. So we started unpacking it for him and lightening it up. And that was the only time he really raged at us. He said, I need to own this pack. It needs to be heavy. It's informing how I move, how I walk, how I breathe. It's informing my rhythm. And so he insisted that the journey for him be as authentic as possible. And we probably walked about, certainly not the whole 500 miles, but certainly about 250 miles. Because again, you know, with a film, it's not like just a pilgrim or a trekker going through the village once. It was take one, take two, take three, and then coverage. And so we would walk through any number of villages, you know, multiple times for the amount of takes that we needed.
We're talking about torturing your dad with my guest, Emilio Estevez, who rescued his film The Way and is getting it back out there. You can also show it at kcrw.com/thetreatment. I'm going to ask you, though, since we're talking about this, and this movie is, I don't want to say getting a new life, because it's been a kind of a constant, and I had to go dig out my DVD. But, you know, it's funny. Even I think the War at Home is not on home video. Was shocked that I had to go dig out my copy of it. And so to have this thing come back into your hands now, because it's got to be for you, we're talking about a journey, the journey of being an independent filmmaker and also looking at film as not only entertainment, although it's principally that for you, but it's also a kind of activism.
It is. And in fact, with this film, the question from Fathom Events was what, this is not an anniversary of the film. This is not it's not a 15 or a 10 year anniversary of the film. How do we make this movie more robust? How do we make this film look like it went to the gym? And so
besides putting 40 pounds on your father's back, how else do you make it feel?
Exactly. No, but after, but again, after that, you know, again, we're releasing it 12 years later. And so how do we create new interest in it? And my girlfriend said, well, why don't we call Rick Steves? And because what Fathom does is they add content at the end of the movie. It's like a panel discussion or behind the scenes footage. We thought Rick Steves, the travel icon, would be a great addition and create a conversation after it about sort of his mission and about travel in general. And so I wrote him. I wrote to his generic email thinking, okay, you know, we're never going to hear from Rick. The next night he calls, By that weekend, we're on a Zoom. And 3 weeks later, we're on a train leaving Los Angeles, going, making our own pilgrimage to Rick Steves in Edmonds, Washington, to shoot this added footage. It's tacked on at the end of the film. It's just 20 minutes of discussion where I'm the moderator and I'm sitting between Martin and Rick, and we're talking about culture and faith and the road is church and the importance of travel and how travel, especially for Americans who have been reluctant to travel. How many Americans actually have a passport? I think the number is very low. So we tucked into Rick's mission, the road is church, and how pilgrimage is important and the reason why we travel. And so there's this lively discussion after the film with Martin and Rick and I, where we cover a lot of these topics. And we obviously, it's a much longer conversation. We shot about an hour and a half of footage. We pared it down to 20 minutes. But indeed, it's to your point, it was transformational in terms of looking at this movie as not just a piece of film, not just an independent movie, but also as a spiritual piece.
Well, how do people see it now? Because again, it shocked me that the number of your films are not readily available to screen. So how do
people
see
it? It's a conspiracy, Elvis. It's a conspiracy. I'm convinced it's a conspiracy. I honestly don't know. I've never chosen the easy road, starting with my name. You know, when back in the day when I wanted to use Sheen initially, and my dad said, no, don't do it. Don't make the mistake that I did. I listened to him. And he told me a story about how his father came to see him in New York when he was doing The Subject Was Roses on Broadway. And his dad looked up at the marquee and didn't see my dad's real name, Ramon Estevez. He saw Martin Sheen and he shook his head. And my dad saw the disappointment. And he said, don't make that same mistake. So, of course, I didn't. And I went with my real name, and it's who I am, and it is part of my identity. It's to be able to celebrate my Hispanic heritage is something that I'm very proud of. But so right now we are in a pay-per-view streaming or a pay-per-view. You have to go to our website, thewaythemovie.com, and you can. There's a couple of buttons you push, and you can watch the movie, and you can stream it to your television, and that's up until. Father's Day until the June 18th, Father's Day. And then we will pivot to streaming and all the various and sundries, all of the Amazon and the Apple. You'll be able to stream it through all of those channels after that. But right now, with this 20-minute additional footage with Rick Steves, you can go to thewaythemovie.com and find it there.
Well, I hope you get around to making another movie soon, or we can revisit another one of your old movies. But it's always a pleasure talking to you, Miguel. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you so much, Elvis. And I hope you make another movie as well, man.
Independent filmmaker and sometimes actor Emilio Estevez, who is supervising the re-release of his 2010 film, The Way, is now available on demand and moves to streaming platforms after Father's Day. Artists, both independent and stylish, can be heard on previous episodes at kcrw.com/thetreatment. The Treatment. It goes with everything. I'm Elvis Mitchell.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. And in the book, The Kingdom of Prep by Maggie Bullock, there's a great quote that kind of summarizes in a way, it's the theme of the story. It's uttered by Mickey Drexler. At one point, she says about him, Mickey was, is, and always will be obsessed with cool. Again, the book is The Kingdom of Prep, the inside story of the rise and near fall of J. Crew. My guest is Maggie Bullock, who's written for places from Vogue to The Atlantic. So that's quite a wide expanse. Maggie, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. I'm exceedingly thrilled to be here.
One of the things I really find so fascinating about the book is that at each point, you make it clear that there's a kind of an authorship. And at some point, there's one person who's kind of responsible for J. Crew, but we peel back a little bit and we see. You start off with Arthur Snader, who's founded the company, but you also make clear that he was a man who was really influenced by the women in his life.
I really think it was his daughter, Emily, who wasn't actually there at the very inception of J.Crew, but joined it pretty much from the moment that it hit consumers' hands, straight out of college when she was just 21 years old. And in terms of authorship, I really think the duality between Arthur Snader, who was so obsessed with the language and the copywriting of the book, and Emily Snader, this sort of young and totally inexperienced woman who just had a feel for the world that she was trying to create and the kind of clothes she wanted to make. The combination of the two is what made J. Crew in the 80s and in the 90s like this cult phenomenon that a lot of people, I find, don't know about.
There's a contrast between the company starting off with people who had a very specific idea about what they wanted. And between Arthur and Emily, they knew what they wanted and they sort of kept their own counsel. And it feels to me that the brand is at its heart, be it from the way it's translated and really formed by Emily or later by Todd Snyder, who's done the show before, by the way. People who knew what they wanted the brand to be and by virtue of exercising their own aesthetics, they created this thing that people responded to.
Yeah, absolutely. And in two very different ways. I mean, I think J. Crew is a company that's had two different lives in a way and represented different things to different people at different times. But in the Snader era, which again started, J. Crew was born into the world in 1983, and the Snader family was in charge of it, running it until 2003. And it really was this sort of American, like, and I use American in quotes, it was their idea of what American good taste should look like and what felt like to them true American style. And they were really tapping into a lot of the sort of age old classics of the preppy world. And translating them to a new generation at that time.
J. Crew has always felt kind of aspirational and straining for authenticity. These people between Arthur and Emily, and then later Jenna and Todd, creating their own version of what authenticity is.
I think in the book, I really try to sort of poke at this authenticity. When you're making a product that is new out of the box, like how authentic can it really be? So to a degree, like authenticity is a total fabrication for this company and many other companies. But what they're trying to do is like tap the thing in your psyche that makes you believe that it's real, that it has history, that it existed for a long time, that it's credible, and that it's kind of, well, in the case of J. Crew, often that it's worth a higher price than what its competitors are selling. You know, the way you achieve authenticity is by being hypersensitive to every nuance of the product and of the language you use to describe the product. I mean, it takes like real harmony within a brand, I think, to achieve this illusion of authenticity. It really is an illusion, as I lay out in the book in more detail, but J. Crew really achieved this sort of perfect pitch authenticity at two different times in its history.
Arthur's concentration on language becomes a key part of what J. Crew is in that catalog, which is that first sort of splashy iteration of J. Crew. And between his verbal command and Emily's command of the visual, I mean, it really was this team, almost like a writer and director working together to create like this cinematic product.
When you looked at this catalog, what you were looking at was the pictures and the words seemed secondary to that. But it's really the marriage of this like sort of pseudo literary elevated with a little ironic twist tone, you know, even in like the caption of a sweater, you know, like that is not a thing that you would give a lot of thought to, right? But it really is part of what they did so well and what separated them from the pack. But also, it was so hard to achieve. I'm talking about the copywriting here. I mean, Arthur Senator really, like, for 20 years, tormented his copy editors to come up with, like, these little pithy, perfect little phrases. You know, they were creating this illusion of ease. The whole idea was that everything in this world looked and felt really, like you said, authentic, natural, and at ease. But the process of describing it and creating that myth was absolutely torturous within the company.
There's this constancy that you actually get in the book in both iterations of the idea of handmade or things being touched. And even the verbiage, the way that Arthur would like fight for these words like honeydew rather than green for color, that becomes a big part of it. This idea of making everything feel like it's touched, you know, that it's rumpled, or that thing that you elucidate that I'd always wondered about, which is when they would shoot, do the cover, the catalog shoots, they would be wrapped in layers just because it'd be freezing cold. And as the day went on, they could peel these things off. But, you know, you see somebody wearing four or five shirts, and I always thought, what is it with these white people and all these clothes all the time?
It's true. What you're talking about was like in the early days of these catalog shoots, the goal in the early day was create a catalog that doesn't feel like a catalog. So basically blow up all the conventions of how these photographs are done. And a huge part of that formula was motion, like keeping the players moving. They were doing things. The people in J.Crew catalogs were sailing and carrying their Christmas trees that they had just cut themselves, obviously. And they were always like horsing around in a way that never actually happens in real life. And partly that was just to like keep them from being these cardboard cutouts who were just on the page to sell you something. You know, it made them look like humans in a real world. But the layering thing I loved when in my interviews this turned up, which is basically like, there are a bunch of kids shooting this catalog in the early days, and they have to go off on these shoots and they have to fill like 100-page catalog, and they have to get a lot of photos out of a single day. I mean, layers were big in the 80s at J.Crew and everywhere else, but J.Crew really did sort of take it to a next level, and it became like a signature thing. You had your t-shirt and your button down and then your sweater, and then you had your barn jacket on top of that. And these people were dressed for the elements at all times. And it was largely like a functional decision, because the stylist, the fashion editor, would layer them up at the start of the day, that she'd send them outside to like make pancakes over an open fire. And then they would, and so she'd get that shot, and then they would peel off the jacket and they would go on to the next activity, and then she'd get the sweater shot. Like, it was a way to like save time between setups.
But that thing you're talking about too, all the activity in those shoots, again, that idea that is not explicitly stated but comes through in each generation, this idea of people using their hands and these clothes that, yes, are rumpled, right, rather than pressed. And so you see people using their hands in these clothes that exist to sort of offer some idea that they're not stamped out by machine. For me, and that gets back to, I think, Arthur and Emily, that they were hands-on with everything. And somehow that ideal came through in that first generation, what they did with the brand.
Well, I think the hand touch that you're talking about and the sort of making the clothes look lived in is such a big part of the mystique of preppy, that an arriviste or a newcomer, a wannabe, doesn't necessarily see. But a big part of the code of preppy or ivy dressing, however you want to call it, is that your clothes don't look like you just bought them. They look like they've been handed down for generations. And this has been true of this code since it sort of evolved into being on Ivy League campuses of American schools in the like 1920s. You could tell the person, the guy who really belonged, by the fact that his Oxford cloth button-down shirt had a frayed cuff and collar. And he didn't worry about his place in society because he was so cemented in his place in society, right? Like, he could afford to look scruffy because no one was knocking him down a few rungs on the ladder. So I think that when you talk about authenticity in fashion, whether you're talking about J. Crew or anywhere else, it is often this illusion that the clothes are worn in, frayed, aged. These are not new. I am not new to this position in society. I've been here for generations.
We're talking about these rumpled clothes, these things that are washed, and this idea of things that don't feel they come right out of the box was, I think, new for women's fashion. Not just like denim, but you know, things that you would consider to be a more formal clothing, and that J. Crew and Emily brought these things that, again, we might think of as being more like the kinds of things we see in menswear to women's fashion, which really, I think, broke down a lot of lines.
Androgyny is really a big part of preppy, or at least women wearing masculine clothes. Let's put it that way. I don't know how androgynous it was, but like preppy retailers, because I don't really want to say designers because it wasn't coming from a designer perspective. Preppy retailers did not cater to women for decades. And so the way that women got in on this look was to buy clothes from the men's department, the boys' department. And in some cases, even when women's versions did start to come out, they still preferred the men's version because I wonder if it's because of that authenticity that we were talking about before, but also maybe because of the slouchy, cooler fit, you know? The point being, like, that is sort of an essential part of the essence of this dress code that J. Crew was bringing into more of a mainstream in the 80s. But also, I think women were entering the workforce in greater numbers in the late 70s, early 80s. They were seeing work as a career and not just a stopgap between school and motherhood. And they needed clothes to wear into the workplace that would not make them the object of sexual attention. A menswear look was a way to look intelligent, educated, kind of cool and above the fray, right? You don't look like you're catering to the male gaze. You don't look like you're looking for attention. And it's funny, after the book came out, a lot of my girlfriends whose mothers would have been in the workforce or coming out of college around that time started swapping pictures with me of their mothers wearing tweed jackets, you know, high-waisted pants, wide collared shirts, like a really kind of what I think is very sexy, but definitely like in a modest, bookish way, like menswear inspired fashion.
Then we go to that explosion of color that becomes the J. Crew of the 21st century and, right. And what Jenna Lyons did. And also what Todd Snyder was doing too, this idea of just bringing color back to what was a much more sort of understated look. In a lot of cases, and as you mentioned in the book, the fabrics were just as good as those being used by much more luxury-minded retailers. But this idea of sort of making J. Crew kind of dandy-ish, and that being like the next extrapolation of what the company was.
J. Crew fell on hard times in the early 2000s. Many retailers did, but it really lost its way. And what had once seemed like a really resonant, like the simplicity of J. Crew that had seemed so resonant for a long time, suddenly, as you know, the winds started to shift, it looked boring. And they just weren't nailing it. And Mickey, the company was like really in dire straits. And Mickey Drexler, who had built the mighty Gap in the 1980s and 90s, so he comes in, it's a Hail Mary for the company at this point. And he zeroes in on Jenna Lyons, this designer who had been at J. Crew since she graduated from college. There's a lot of parallels between Jenna Lyons and Emily Senator. Jenna was also like 21, I think, when she joined the company and had worked her way up. Mickey also brought over your friend Todd Snyder, who is now the king of American menswear, pretty much. So he brought Todd over from Gap Inc. And it wasn't an overnight thing, but they did really reinvent the look of J. Crew. And in order to do that, they kind of had to break the pieces of Emily's look and put them back together in a totally new way. So they had to break all of Emily's rules. You know, Emily's rules were like no ornamentation, no trends, period, nothing loud. you know, she, it was all so super subdued and quiet. And what Jenna made, which really defined J. Crew, was she broke all those rules while somehow managing to keep a recognizable piece of the original DNA intact. And Jenna created this amalgam of a look, which was by turns menswear inspired. It was sort of shiny. There was lots of glitter. There was beading. It was super exuberant. It depends on how you feel about it, right? But for many, many people, I think Jenna's look was more welcoming and more inclusive and more, well, it was more in step with its own time. But it totally shook up what J. Crew had been, which is really kind of what you have to do with a brand. You know, it runs its course of its original look, and it has to be able to stay true to what it was and what it represents, while also pivoting to a new era. And I think that what Jenna and Mickey did with J. Crew was pretty miraculous. But they did get a lift from a first lady, so that was also pretty lucky.
My guest is Maggie Bullock. Her terrific book is The Kingdom of Prep, the inside story of the rise and near fall of J. Crew. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis. I really never heard of them either. I guess we're from different scenes. She says she used to model for J. Crew,
but I don't know what that means. The book, The Kingdom of Prep, chronicles the rise and fall and rise of Style House J. Crew, and it's by writer Maggie Bullock. It's available now. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. She says she used to kind of be neighbors with the guy who sang Let Love Rule. She says she also danced in a Gap ad that I just see on TV. She says she used to model for J. Crew. I'd like to know what that means. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat. Actor Joe Manganiello, whose work has taken us from True Blood and beyond on a pleasure that got his blood truly roused, forgive me, and whose stars got to be a bigger part of his life recently.
Hi, I'm Joe Manganiello, and this is The Treat. Pulp Fiction came out at that point when I knew I was going to be an actor, and I had set out on that path. I'd seen Reservoir Dogs, I'd seen True Romance, and I saw Pulp Fiction 8 times in the theater. And it just changed everything. I mean, just the way that Tarantino wrote the voices of the characters. He wrote like a theater writer, like a great theater writer. And the way that he edited the film, the way that he turned those stories on their head, like we'd seen those stories before a million times. The boxer who's supposed to throw the fight and doesn't. And, you know, there were these kind of like familiar tropes that he just completely, you know, turned on its head.
See, this business is filled to the brim with unrealistic m****s. Who thought their ass would age like wine. If you mean it turns to vinegar, it does. If you mean it gets better with age, it don't.
It was one of those films at the right time that made me so excited about film, and I remember seeing it at the Beehive Theater in Oakland, Pittsburgh. You could buy alcohol there, you could bring your own alcohol in. They had couches in the back, and if you got there early, you could get the couches, and you could smoke in the theater, like True Romance, you know? So there was a double feature of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, and we got there early, got the couches, brought in a bunch of six-packs, a bunch of packs of Camel cigarettes, and we just smoked cigarettes and drank beer and quoted the movie the whole time and just laughed, and, you know, I'll never forget that. I have a weird way of manifesting things. And last year I had the pleasure of starring in a film with Uma Thurman and Sam Jackson, which is the first time that they've gotten back together for a film since Pulp Fiction, called The Kill Room. which is like being submitted to festivals right now, and will, you know, land somewhere over the next year. You can buy to be in like a bunch of three-person scenes with me, Sam, and Uma after having that movie really just explode my mind in the way that it did, and really just make me so excited to get into this business and be here, gosh, into my third decade and get to work with those two. Man, it's pretty cool. And Pulp Fiction, it just planted a seed in me that grew a tree this past year, and I'm excited for everybody to get to see Kill Room when it comes up. Going down to Lonesome Town
to cry my troubles away. Actor Joe Manganiello on the enduring treat that is Pulp Fiction. Past treats, including a take on the impact of the film The Wild Bunch on writer-director Ron Shelton, can be enjoyed at kcow.com/thetreat. Films, fashion, fiction, and fact, cultural phenomena that shape the hearts of creators, are shared by creative minds from all fields of endeavor. We call it The Treat. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Getty Gilchrist. We got help from Anna Buss and Laura Kondarajan. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.